Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of Oncology Decoded, Cancer Science Meets Clarity. We are your hosts, Manoj and Ben, and we're excited to kick off this podcast with a deep dive into a key topic in kidney cancer, adjuvant therapy. In this episode, we'll break down what adjuvant therapy is, how it fits into kidney cancer therapy treatment, and what the latest research tells us.
Manoj, this is so exciting. This is our first episode, and I do think we need to level set here. So why don't you clarify, what do you mean by adjuvant therapy?
Great question, Ben. I think it depends, right? So typically we think about adjuvant therapy, meaning that somebody's getting additional treatment after primary treatment. So for example, surgery. You get surgery, and then what additional things are we doing? And what is the goal? It's to eliminate any microscopic cells that might still be lingering and reduce the risk of cancer recurrence. For kidney cancer, the primary treatment is often surgery, a procedure called nephrectomy, where part or all the kidney is removed. But even after successful surgery, there is a risk of recurrence, and that's where the adjuvant therapy comes in.
Yeah, I think what makes this topic so exciting is we're actually talking about curative intent. All too often in cancer, we're talking about prolonging disease, prolonging survival with disease, or managing toxicities with disease. But here we're actually trying to cure patients. And this is a good place if you're a patient to be, right? Because it's never fun to have cancer. But if we can cure you of your disease and get you back to life, then I think that's a great thing, right? So all too often, I'm going to go back to where you were. Okay, because I don't like saying it's a good thing to have cancer. So I'm going to go back. All right. Thanks. I think this is a really exciting topic because we're talking about curative intent therapy. All too often in oncology, we're not able to talk about how to get a cure, but instead we're talking about how do we prolong your survival with the disease and help you live better for longer. But here we're actually trying to cure, get rid of disease, and get your patients back to living, right? So in kidney cancer, there's a few of different types of adjuvant therapies. There's been targeted therapies and immunotherapy. So what do we mean by targeted therapy? These are drugs that you take that actually target a specific protein or something intracellular, a signaling pathway that will slow down the cancer cell and perhaps kill the cancer cell. That's the goal. So in kidney cancer, particularly in clear cell kidney cancer, we're talking about vascular endothelial growth factor, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or VEGF TKIs, which probably Manoj and I are going to be calling TKIs for the rest of the podcast. So how do these drugs work, right? So in clear cell kidney cancer, that's about 70% of kidney cancer. It's the majority, the most common subtype. Most patients will have some kind of aberration on chromosome 3p or VHL, which is a protein named after von Hippel-Lindau. And that causes a stabilization of a protein called HIF, or hypoxia-inducible factor. Basically, I'm a cancer cell. I'm starving for oxygen. Feed me, induce something. Well, what does that induce? That induces increased VEGF signaling, vascular blood vessels, endothelial, the cells that line those blood vessels, growth factor, right? So VEGF signaling increases. That cancer cell brings in more blood supply and nutrients to feed it so it can grow, divide, and spread. So when we start talking about VEGF inhibitors or TKIs, obviously you could see how these could be deployed in the adjuvant setting as well as in the metastatic setting to prevent cancer growth and survival. So we've had a lot of drugs studied with VEGF inhibitors in this space. There's also immunotherapy. Immunotherapy are IV infusions that we give our patients. They're called checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1, it's all the same, where we actually rev up the patient's immune system to fight the cancer cells that may be lurking in their body. So think about blocking that signal that allows that cancer cell to evade detection from our own body's immune surveillance. So that's immunotherapy. You could see how that would work in adjuvant therapy as well. So Manoj, why don't you give us a little bit of history lesson while I've discussed the mechanisms? Teach us about what you know about adjuvant TKIs in kidney cancer.
Oh, that's a great question. There adjuvant therapies with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, really, there's been a number of them, right? So there's been about six trials or so. As you know, Ben, there's been only one trial that has been shown to be benefit. That was the ESTRACT trial. This was the trial that looked at sunitinib, which is a targeted therapy and indicated for patients with high-risk kidney cancer. These results show that patients who took sunitinib for 1 year had longer disease-free survival compared to those who received a placebo. However, the side effects were quite significant, including fatigue, blood pressure, and foot syndrome. And the disease-free benefit, survival benefit, was about as long as patients were on therapy, so about a year. And there was no significance in overall survival.
If the goal is extending survival from cancer, and all adjuvant sunitinib is doing is providing increased toxicity while you're living well after your surgery and doesn't actually extend the amount of time you actually live, right? Then what's the purpose? Just so you can feel bad for a year to extend the amount of time that your cancer is going to come back by a year. To me, that doesn't seem worth it, though perhaps there are people out there where that might be worth it. But the other thing we need to do is actually think about the other adjuvant TKIs that have tried and failed in this space. Sorafenib, pazopanib, axitinib have all not even shown a significant disease-free survival in our patients, which means the amount of time from the surgery and taking the therapy until the cancer comes back. So you have to put that in the context with a bunch of failure, unfortunately. And then also the mTOR inhibitor everolimus. Now, I know that's not a VEGF TKI, it's more of an immunomodulatory oral therapy, but that also didn't provide any kind of disease-free or overall survival benefit. So when you have one trial that's questionably positive, I would say it is positive, but it's not as clinically meaningful, and a bunch of negative trials, well, maybe we shouldn't be providing adjuvant TKIs in the space. And I think that brings us then to the other category we were talking about earlier. What about adjuvant immunotherapy? Manoj, can you tell us about KEYNOTE-564?
Yeah, Ben, before we go on to the KEYNOTE-564 study with immunotherapy, let me ask you a provocative question here. Has there ever been a situation where you thought of using any of these TKIs because a patient came to you and said, "Give me anything. I will do whatever it takes, even if the benefit's minimal"?
Yeah, personally, no, I've never given it. And I don't think I would ever recommend an adjuvant TKI in this setting unless new data sets came out. You know, I'll keep an open mind. But for now, I think the answer is no. And I would actually counsel my patients not to do it. And one of the easiest ways to counsel a patient when you think you should be guiding them one way or another is you go ahead and recommend what you would do for your own family. And I would not recommend that anyone in my family take adjuvant sunitinib for this disease right now.
I totally share the same sentiment, same thing completely. So getting on to adjuvant immunotherapy, so KEYNOTE-564 was the only trial was a trial that explored pembrolizumab. People may know it as Keytruda, an immune checkpoint inhibitor. The findings were promising. It showed a clear benefit in reducing the risk of recurrence for patients who are high risk and translating it to an overall survival benefit and reducing the risk of recurrence or death by nearly 30%. Which is the reason why it was led to the FDA, had the FDA approval for adjuvant kidney cancer for specifically clear cell kidney cancer, not any other type of RCC. And while these results are promising, not all immunotherapy has actually been to be, not all immunotherapy has been to show ha shown to have the same benefits. You look at InMotion-010, which looked at 1 year of atezolizumab, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor, and you look at CheckMate 914. There were two different cohorts. One was using ipilimumab and nivolumab, and the other one was using nivolumab monotherapy, neither of which showed any benefit. Additionally, there was another study that was looking at neoadjuvant. We talked about adjuvant earlier, talking about using therapy after a primary modality of intervention. Here, neoadjuvant, meaning we do some sort of therapy first, then going to surgery. So in PROSPER, there was use of nivolumab followed by surgery and nine additional doses. However, none of these studies showed any benefit overall. The highlights of adjuvant therapy is really not a one-size-fits-all, and it really is an individual risk factor driven.
Yeah, Manoj, I think these are great points. And I love that you have that encyclopedic knowledge about the number of doses and the number of months, right? So I think you just told us that there was a great positive study, right? And then you just gave us information about three studies that didn't look so great, right? Negative studies. And I just went on this podcast about what, 3 minutes earlier and just said, well, let's interpret sunitinib, a somewhat positive trial, in the context of a bunch of negative trials, and then tilted the scales towards don't do it, right? But I'm going to be a little bit different here. And maybe that's fair, maybe that's not, but this is just what we have to do in clinic with the patients in front of us. We have to make the best decisions we can. Look, maybe we can explain away the atezolizumab data set, which was a year of adjuvant PD-L1 inhibitor, because there's emerging consensus data that perhaps PD-1 inhibitors work better than PD-L1 inhibitors in clear cell renal cell carcinoma. There's a variety of reasons that these are drugs that hit slightly different targets in different ways, and perhaps there's a difference there from a mechanistic standpoint. So let's toss that trial aside. All right, what about nivolumab or ipilimumab and nivolumab versus pembro? Nivo is a PD-1 inhibitor. Pembro is a PD-1 inhibitor. Obviously, ipilimumab is a CTLA-4 inhibitor. I'm not going to go here and say that there's a difference between Pembro and Nevo, but what I will say is that different trial designs, right? So maybe 6 months and 12 months, maybe that does make a difference, right? So I think when we think about how much immunotherapy to give, that may be relevant. Of course, it is a bit complicated and confusing, right? And then when you think about the neoadjuvant study, the PROSPER study, where there was some early infusion of nivolumab surgery, there was a lot of dropout. So I think statistically speaking, that's a much harder trial to analyze. So overall, if we start to explain away, which may or may not be fair, it's at least biased what I want to do because I want to have a trial that works and extends survival, right? We both do. That I think adjuvant pembrolizumab is still a very reasonable choice in the context of all these negative immunotherapy studies. So I think then it goes to, well, who should we give it to, right?
Well,
And I think let's,
before you talk
yeah,
about who
go
you're going to
ahead.
give it to, I'm curious when you look at when you're looking at the pembrolizumab data, how much do you think the patients that had the M1 disease, right? Those patients that had that oligomet that got treated that were enrolled into the KEYNOTE-564, do you think that those patients may have somewhat skewed the results comparing it to all the other trials which didn't really include that group of patients?
Yeah, great point. And now you're really testing me. So the M1 NED population, right? So no evidence of disease. So basically, these are patients that got diagnosed with one or two metastases, had a nephrectomy, had a metastatectomy to remove all these sites of disease, were rendered via CT scans with no evidence of cancer. But obviously, they had had spread prior, right? So you knew that there might be some circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream. Clearly, they're going to probably benefit from some kind of systemic therapy. Don't quote me because I don't have my notes in front of me, but I'm going to say I think that was like 5.5%, maybe 5.4% on the dot. Please, in the comments of our podcast session, tell me if I'm wrong on this because Manoj isn't going to necessarily check me in real time. So yes, those patients did the best on the study when you look at those forest plots and the subgroup analyses. However, that's a small patient population. What drove the actual study? Well, in the inclusion criteria, right? So anyone with a T2 high grade 4 or sarcomatoid features were allowed on this study, any T3 or T4 or any node positive patient. And if you look at the data, the vast majority of patients on the study were those T3 N0 patients. So patients that we would all say had the lowest risk out of all of those I just mentioned were the biggest amount of patients in the study. So when you have about 80 to 85% being T3 in the study, I think that's pretty relevant to, can we apply this to a broader population? Not just go after the most high-risk patients, but actually go after the bulk of the patients to try to provide them perhaps better chance of cure. To discuss that though, I mean, Manoj, how do you analyze risk stratification in a patient who just had a nephrectomy? Forget the M1 NED population, which is obviously super high risk because they already have a systemic illness. But how do you stratify? Do you use any of those calculators that are out there?
You know, that's an interesting point. I personally, I do and I don't. I think there are situations where you're kind of on the fence and not really sure if you really need to or not. From a clinical perspective, you're worried about from what you're seeing, but they don't really fit the true definition of high risk based on the KEYNOTE study, right? So someone may have a large size tumor, but they're not a T3, but then it may fall into a T2, but really a grade 2, not a grade 4. And so some of those challenges, if you know, when you look at it, make it a little bit harder. Also, if you have a younger patient, but you know that the biology seems wrong or more worrisome, but you don't really quite know how to make a decision clinically because they don't fit into that, again, that true high risk definition for the trial, I think there's some nomograms that you can use. So specifically, there are two, right? So you can use the Memorial Sloan Kettering nomogram or the Fox Chase Center nomogram. The Memorial Sloan Kettering was actually was a tool that was helped to predict the likelihood of cancer recurrence after nephrectomy. And it uses patient clinical and pathologic features such as tumor grade, size, stage, lymph node involvement. And it generates a personalized risk score, and it can help guide discussions whether adjuvant therapy may be beneficial or not. And it's based on data from thousands of kidney cancer cases previously and has been validated across multiple patient populations. The Fox Chase nomogram is another tool And that was designated for patients with localized kidney cancer as well. And it incorporated additional factors such as symptoms at time of diagnosis, such as pain or hematuria. And it also included type of surgery, partial versus radical nephrectomy. And it provides a 5-year estimate for cancer recurrence. And it can help make a treatment decision based on prognosis and post-surgical treatment options as well. Ben, do you ever use either one of them?
Look, I think these tools can probably be helpful for providers who see less kidney cancer. So if you're a hardworking community oncologist and you're trying to get some information to patients who are asking very difficult questions to you in real time, I think pulling up one of these nomograms is the best way to give that patient the information that they want to help make that decision in that shared decision making that we all cherish so much between a provider and a patient, right? But to me, do I actually use these? No, the answer is no, I don't. I see so much kidney cancer. I kind of have a better sense of who's more likely to recur and who's not, just from those features that you're kind of mentioning and those that clinical gestalt that we think we have, right? We think we're clinical experts here. But I do think they can be useful. I wouldn't completely write them out. I just don't personally use them that much in my own practice. And I guess when we're balancing the thought of, well, who's at higher risk, maybe who should get this therapy, we need to balance that in the context with the side effects of the therapy, right? Because we know that a lot of these patients who have had a nephrectomy or a partial nephrectomy are going to be cured of their disease regardless of what we do. So then we have to think about the real-world clinical toxicity as well as the financial toxicity that we may be inducing on our patients by giving them therapy. So can you kind of tell me what are some of the risks, common side effects of pembrolizumab?
Yeah, so generally, I tell patients when I'm talking about pembrolizumab, imagine your head, imagine your body from head to toe, and add an itis to every single part of your body, right? That's in theory what pembrolizumab or any immunotherapy can do. So top to down, you can get itises of your encephalitis, right? Uveitis. You can get optic neuritis. You can get mucositis and thyroid issues, lung issues, and liver toxicity, skin rashes, colitis, any of these things. Fortunately, though, the general risk of any of these major side effects is pretty low. And from a clinical perspective, fortunately, we don't see them that often. Most often, it's probably skin rashes or skin irritation and elevation of TSH, and are oftentimes relatively manageable.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it's hard to talk about this with our patients in real time in clinic, right? One, the way you just described it sounded like one of those commercials you see while you're watching TV. And it's terrifying because all these organs are going to go wrong. Ah, Dr. Bhupathi, help me, right? No. So look, I think you're right. And what I do is I try to give a general sense. And this is from my understanding of all the various literature with anti-PD-1 based immune therapy and distilling down to treatment emergent versus treatment related adverse events and how they compare to control arms in those studies and trying to do some basic crude math. But what I say is, if I have a patient in front of me, I say, look, there's about a 1 in 3 chance you're going to have some kind of inflammation, some kind of itis, just like you mentioned. I go, yeah, lungs, shortness of breath, cough, pneumonitis, colon, diarrhea, colitis, skin, rash, dermatitis, thyroid. I never say thyroiditis, but I could. I don't know why I don't. Needing supplementation, right? I mean, these are the big ones. There's obviously others. And I'll say there's about a 30% chance that is going to happen. However, most of the time, I'm going to give you a week or two of steroids and everything's going to go back to normal. You're going to be totally just fine, right? And then there's also chances we're going to tinker with your blood work here and there. And again, something will be just fine. I do think, though, there is that risk of serious toxicity. We talk about brain, right? Or heart. And I do let my patients know. I used to work in the ICU at MD Anderson. We would see these patients, they would be flown in and they'd be super sick, right? And we occasionally see them in our own practices in the real world setting in the community as well. And what I'll say is these are rare. Maybe 1 in 10 is going to have a more sticky problem. And that's the way I say a sticky problem, because that means months to 2 months of immune suppression with all the side effects, or perhaps a life-altering side effect. And then that very rare instance of actually a life-ending side effect. But I think when I say 30%, 10%, and then I say like 2%, right? Just to make them kind of feel better about taking the therapy if they want to do it. And I think that's a good way to kind of counsel a patient on the side effects of immunotherapy, even though I know those numbers don't exactly line up with the trial. I think it's a better way that a patient can psychologically understand the potential consequences of the burden of that therapy. And then when we move forward to thinking about, well, we talked about toxicity, right? We've talked about when to use it. I like to use it probably more than more than some of the other colleagues. I tend to use it for anyone who is eligible for the study. But that does have real implications on what we could do next in those unfortunate situations where a patient isn't cured of their disease and their cancer recurs after getting adjuvant immunotherapy. This is the question number one in the kidney cancer world in both the community and the academic centers, right? What do we do next? So why don't you tell me what you think we should do if a patient's progressing on adjuvant pembrolizumab?
So are you asking me if what I would do if somebody's getting pembrolizumab and I'm doing imaging that's telling me progressive disease?
Exactly. You have a patient in clinic on Monday. They're on adjuvant pembrolizumab, and unfortunately, a CT scan that you're doing for surveillance shows that the cancer's come back.
Yeah, this is, I think, when we had the tools of using adjuvant immunotherapy, it was fantastic. And now that we've been using it for a little while, this is now the time that I think we can potentially start seeing the situation. And I think it really depends on timing and duration of pembrolizumab, right? So on the trial, you were giving pembrolizumab for 1 year and then stopping and kind of just doing surveillance imaging to see what would happen at that point. If how I think about it is if patients are on active therapy and you're seeing imaging while they're receiving pembrolizumab that shows that there's progressive disease, I interpret that patient to be different than those that have completed adjuvant therapy and then you're seeing progression after treatment is completed. I think we're talking about two separate types of patients, and even maybe a third type of patient where you start on pembrolizumab and they progress within the first 3 months versus somebody that progresses 9 months after starting on pembrolizumab. I think there's different biological mechanisms for these type of patients. And I think that plays a big role in terms of figuring out how would you define your second line of therapy? Are you really going to second line of therapy? Or is it really first line therapy? So to start off with, I would say for patients who've finished pembrolizumab, and if they've finished 6 months later and then they start seeing progression, I wouldn't really consider them as a failure of pembrolizumab. I'd probably treat them as a new first line therapy again. However, if patients are progressing while on pembrolizumab and it's within the first 6 months, I would say that they are probably, the biology of their cancer is probably immune resistant, in which case it doesn't make sense to continue on pembrolizumab and probably go to a second line therapy. And we have two trials now. We have the CONTACT-02 trial, and we also have TiNivo-2 that shows us that continuing immunotherapy after progressing on immunotherapy doesn't make any, doesn't, does not help. So those are patients that I would switch to a second line therapy and go to a TKI potentially. How do you think about these patients, Ben? Are there different buckets that you put them in?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned those trials. And now we're going to do the things that we're not supposed to do, which is extrapolate, right, based off of data sets. But it's what we have to do in the real world, right? We can't wait for every trial when we have a patient with us in clinic next week. So TiNivo CONTACT-02 and TiNivo-2, I'm glad you mentioned those trials. CONTACT-02, they're both in the metastatic setting. CONTACT-02 looking at upon progression of immunotherapy, whether ipi/nivo or some IO TKI combination, there's three that are FDA approved in the metastatic setting. The randomization to cabo versus cabo plus atezo. So cabozantinib, obviously a VEGF TKI, atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor we talked about earlier. And there's no difference by continuing on with immunotherapy by adding an atezolizumab in that setting. TiNivo-2, looking at the randomization after immunotherapy to either tivozanib and nivolumab, tivozanib being a VEGF TKI, nivolumab being the PD-1 inhibitor, versus tivozanib alone. And then again, no difference, right? So if we can say in the metastatic setting, once you've progressed on anti-PD-1 based therapy, the continuation of immunotherapy doesn't help, right? So then now is the point where we have to do the things that technically we're not always supposed to do, which is extrapolate from that setting and bring it on earlier in the disease state. And if you say cancer cells are becoming resistant to checkpoint inhibitor therapy in that setting, well, they're probably doing the exact same thing in the earlier setting. Now, there are some differences. There's nuances in the tumor microenvironment. That's not a perfect answer. We do need to answer this question with clinical trials. But for right now, I think the answer is you don't continue immunotherapy if you think that patient's PD-1 resistant. So in my definition, I agree. If they're just started pembro and on that first scan 3 months later, they're progressing, maybe we're going to hope that that pseudo progression, it doesn't happen very often, or but they didn't get enough immunotherapy again. That doesn't happen very often. They're probably primary resistant, but I'm more likely to just say continue pembro, add in a VEGF TKI. And there's many VEGF TKIs that are approved in this setting that you can use. If they're progressing on immunotherapy and it's been longer than 3 months and they're actively on adjuvant pembro, I stop immunotherapy altogether and they're on VEGF TKI monotherapy or on a clinical trial with some other combination. I think once they've stopped, that's where it gets more complicated. You've described that. I think if they're progressing 3 months after stopping, I mean, those receptors are still saturated with the PD-1 inhibitors. We know that those circulate around for 2 to 3 months. So I would not start immunotherapy. It's been over a year since they've completed immunotherapy. Obviously, we're going to continue immunotherapy or rechallenge. I think the gray area is in that 6 to 12 month time, where personally, I probably would do it in clinic in the real world because patients want access to this therapy. But I don't know that we know the answer. And if we ran that trial, I think that subset of patients is going to be a more complicated readout of the results. But that's me future tripping on potential trials that may or may not be developed. And right now, that's currently how I'm thinking about this line of therapy. And I guess when we think of, we've talked a lot about surgery and adjuvant therapy and then sequencing from the perioperative space to the frontline metastatic space if a patient received adjuvant therapy. But is there anything that we can do to extrapolate, which again, we're not supposed to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to put you on the spot here. What if a patient had radiation instead of surgery? We know that the data with SBRT, both to the primary lesion in kidney cancer, as well as the oligometastatic lesions in kidney cancer, I think that is evolving and it's looking more and more promising as we get more and more data sets out there. Would you ever consider adjuvant immunotherapy if you radiated a primary or if you radiated a site of oligometastasis?
Yeah, I know that's a very provocative question.
That's why I'm not answering it. That's why I asked you. Yeah.
I think I would. I think I would. It depends on the right clinical situation, right? Or how big of a tumor are we talking about? What does the performance status look like for the individual? How much of a metastatic or oligomet are we defining it, right? The definition of oligomet seems to be somewhat variable depending on which trial you're looking at. And it varies depending on which tumor type you're looking at as well, right? And across institutions, there's actually a variable definition where it can go from about 4 all the way to 10, depending on who the individual is from a radiation standpoint or even from a medical oncology standpoint. And so I think those variables do play a role. Now, if you have a very super small size tumor that you're doing primary SBRT to, and you don't have any other disease sites, patient's elderly, probably not going to give them immunotherapy. However, if it's a younger patient or more fit patient, larger size tumor has either a lymph node or something, or a isolated lung nodule, I probably would give them immunotherapy. Now, this is where that pros and cons of talking about it and evaluating the benefits are probably the most important thing. But I do think that there is a role for it. I'm going to flip it back onto you. When you think about your second line TKI for those that are progressing, is your go-to always cabozantinib? I mean, cabozantinib has kind of been this been the savior, for lack of better words, for second line kidney cancer, right? We've seen that from METEOR back in 2015, 2016. But now with TINOVO2, that's showing that you can use single agent tivozanib and having a relatively impressive PFS as a single agent drug, what would you do?
Yeah, I think it's just an embarrassment of riches, which is a better place to be than just having one drug. I think cabozantinib, we should say, it has the highest quality data to support it in this space, right? It is a multi-kinase VEGF TKI, which means it hits that VEGF receptor, which causes the hypertension and all these other things. But it also hits some of these other receptors as well that we might hypothesize on their immune stimulation or other things. Tivozanib is more of a VEGF selective TKI, and their toxicity profile is a little bit different. So I think it's depending on that patient in front of you. Now we have a choice to provide a more VEGF selective TKI if we're a little bit concerned about some of the off VEGF target toxicity, such as the GI side effects and skin changes that we may see more commonly with cabozantinib. But again, I think they're all reasonable. It's nice to have new data in this setting, and I think that you can't really go wrong. And as long as you understand how to use the drug and manage toxicity, which I think we need to talk about in another podcast, is how to manage VEGF TKI toxicity, especially when you're deciding the combination of the VEGF TKI and the immunotherapy, because I do think that is an interesting conversation to be had and is very unique based on all the various combinations that are out there. So I think we'll talk about that hopefully sometime soon.
Ben, I think we confused all of our listeners in terms of adjuvant therapy as well as second line therapy if they were to progress. If you were to summarize, what would you say would be the takeaway here for patients, for those that you're giving immunotherapy to for high risk and they progress, what would you actually do?
If they're progressing on after adjuvant pembrolizumab, I think single
Correct.
agent monotherapy VEGF TKI is the go-to. My go-to has been cabozantinib, given the data in that space, but now we have other reasonable options as well. And that may change in the future as we start to get more data, more real-world clinical practice. And then I also think about clinical trials in this setting to give a combination to a patient that otherwise wouldn't get it. So you can always refer your patients to, local community sites that have high research programs like our own, as well as academic sites, or as we expand out the community oncology research portfolio through Sarah Cannon, hopefully more trials closer to you. And I do think the one thing we failed to mention, though, is we've been talking about clear cell renal cell cancer. This does not apply to variant histologies. I personally do not use adjuvant pembrolizumab in most variant histologies. Think about papillary, chromophobe, et cetera. We know response rates to single agent checkpoint inhibitors are about 10% less in the metastatic setting. So if we move that up and thought critically about the perioperative setting, like in the adjuvant setting, we have less responses. The metastatic setting, we're probably going to have less responses in the adjuvant setting, which makes me think that risk benefit is probably tilted. So that study would have to be run before I was convinced say to give adjuvant pembrolizumab to a papillary renal cell carcinoma patient, which is the second most common subtype, about 15% of kidney cancer. So I think we should make that as well. So my take home away is this is an exciting option for patients. We should be giving adjuvant pembrolizumab. Unfortunately, if a patient progresses on adjuvant pembrolizumab, our lives as providers just got more complicated because immunotherapy is not going to help most of those patients. And we're stuck now with monotherapy TKIs or belzutifan after the TKIs to help our patients in clinic, which tends not to be a curative therapy, which is the unfortunate part of this. What are your last thoughts, Manoj?
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well. I would just say that, it really depends on the time of progression. That time of progression is really what would define how you think about, is it truly a second line in addition to a TKI, or is it really a first line therapy? And we don't have any guidance in terms of saying that it's going to be 6 months, it's going to be a year, it's going to be 6 months to a year. We don't have those guidance, and we just don't have that because we have not seen that in kidney cancer. We have it in bladder cancer in terms of how you define progression after first line therapy, right? Generally, we think about it as anything less than a year, it's probably more going to be second line therapy. After 12 months of completing definitive therapy, we think about it more as second line, first line therapy. So I think here, I think it's going to be an evolving in general, but that's what I would say. I think we just have to be mindful of when the time of progression is actually occurring to make that decision.
Yeah, but we got to give the guidance. So I'm leaning on 6 months after the completion of pembrolizumab for now. That's my recommendation, but it's not set in stone. And I admit that I may change my mind in a future podcast in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. We'll find out.
I'm not disagreeing with the 6 months. I'm just saying that if they're progressing while on pembrolizumab, then if it's within the first 3 months, I would add a TKI. If it's
Agreed.
after 6 months, then go to second line therapy. And if they've
Agreed.
completed altogether, then I would support exactly what you're saying.
So we just came up with a community consensus right there. There you go. All right.
Awesome.
Oncology Decoded, Cancer Science Meets Clarity.
Be sure to join us next time for more thought-provoking discussions and expert insights.